we get this hour underway by welcoming back to the program a Pulitzer Prize finalist, journalist, and author of a number of wonderful books, including Area 51, Phenomena, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, and her brand new one, First Platoon, A Story of Modern War in the Age of Identity Dominance. We are happy to welcome Annie Jacobson back to downtown. Annie, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, I love all of your books so much, and every time I say, why do I do this to myself? Because I read your books, and then I just can't stop thinking about them for hours on end. And this one, I have not been able to get out of my head. It's a fascinating and at times horrifying tale. Was it your research for Surprise, Kill, Vanish that piqued your interest in biometrics and their implications?
You know, it was, because I was writing about CIA paramilitary operators in Surprise, Kill, Vanish. These are like former Delta, SEAL, you know, tier one operators with decades of experience going into the war theater, most of whom are sort of in their, you know, the average age is 40, let's say. And what they do in the theater is so different than what these young, straight out of college, 18, 19-year-old private first class were doing in the war theater in Afghanistan. And what they were doing was just so astonishing to me. They didn't even know that they were part of this program to capture biometrics. And the whole sort of setup to that was just sort of like head-twisting in a number of ways. And, you know, you said you kind of were frightened reading the book. My God, that was my experience writing it. It was like, what hath we wrought?
It was very interesting, too, as you sort of traced the history of recognition techniques from, I believe it was with the Bertillon system, to, of course, fingerprints, mugshots, facial recognition technology, and now this, and what's called BAT, the Biometric Automated Toolset. Can you explain how that all works?
Yes, yes. I mean, there are two stories in First Platoon. The one is, of course, the story of these very young soldiers who go to Afghanistan. Their deployment ends in catastrophe. They're ensnared in a war crime, which they really had nothing to do with. And that's just like story number one. But story number two that entwines around this is the sort of birth and rise, like frightening rise, of the Defense Department's biometric systems. This idea that it wants to build the most powerful database in the world of human measurements, fingerprints, facial images, iris scans, DNA, in order to tag, track, and then locate people who are not yet criminals, who are not yet terrorists. And that is frightening when you consider that this system, born of war, is now here in the United States looking at a lot of us as well.
Was the impetus for this biometric use the effort to capture the man known as the 20th 9/11 hijacker?
That's right. And it's such a remarkable origin story, and it has this feeling of like, wow, you know, the original ideas of some of these programs are often, you know, somewhat that you could say they were a good idea. The biometrics of the 20th hijacker were located by the Defense Department simply because an FBI agent, a really sharp, dedicated FBI agent named Paul Shannon, whose story I tell in the book and who I interviewed at length, comes up with this idea right after 9/11, saying to the, you know, taking his FBI experience, capturing fingerprints, and saying to the DOD, hey, we need to get the fingerprints on all these sort of mysterious men fleeing the battlefield in Afghanistan. This is like in the early, early days right after 9/11. And it was such a noble idea. And he gets the fingerprints, and it's literally a 1 in 6.5 billion person match hit. He finds the 20th hijacker from his fingerprints. And so that sets off this idea of, oh my God, this could change how we fight wars. We could move from looking at big armies, this is we, the Pentagon, from like watching an entire army to honing in on one individual. And if we could stop that individual, maybe we could stop the next terror attack and therefore stop the next war. What a noble idea. It all goes to hell in a handbasket.
And the military and the Pentagon launched this gigantic plan to, well, essentially scan everybody in Afghanistan. And it was not an easy process. And I was taken aback to learn that they would even do it with people who had been killed.
That's right. And this is actually what the young soldiers of 1st Platoon and thousands of others like them were doing in Afghanistan, having no idea what they were doing or why they were doing it. I mean, as recently as last year, when I'm interviewing these guys, they're saying, Annie, biometrics? What? That was just such a tiny part of the program. Well, it wasn't, I learned, and as I report, that in fact, the Defense Department had this big plan to get biometrics on everyone. The goal was 80%. Of the entire population of Afghanistan. Forget about Fourth Amendment rights of, you know, of right to privacy. They just had these soldiers out getting fingerprints, getting iris scans, getting DNA off of everybody, including, as you say, you know, dead people.
We're talking with Annie Jacobson here on Downtown. There were mistakes along the way by the military. One that stands out early in the book is the incident where copies of the Quran were burned.
I mean, there are so many tragic elements of this story and missteps, and the Quran burning is one of them. And the reason why I reported that story in the book was because it was such a sort of tragic example of what I always look at when I'm reporting it, which is a kind of fate and circumstance that befalls some of the people that I write about that I'm so interested in. And that was certainly the case with the young soldiers of 1st Platoon. They arrive in Afghanistan, and within days, the Quran burnings happen. And it's like an incendiary moment where you realize things are now going to get even worse for these kind of unwitting soldiers who are there on the ground, not to fight wars in any kind of sense that we used to know about fighting wars, but capturing biometrics. You're acting like cops on a beat, going around, sort of knocking on the door, hey, can I get your iris scans? Absolutely, as one soldier said to me, do not want us there. And these, the Quran burning and another terrible situation that happens, which is the massacre of 16 Afghan civilians by an army soldier named Robert Bales, who went rogue. These kind of horrors to the people living there made it almost impossible for our young American soldiers to function. And yet, this is what was going on. What is the bigger plan? That's always what I'm interested in. Why is this happening? And ultimately, why does no one in America know about this? The program wasn't secret. It wasn't a classified program, but it sure was secretive.
For the young men of 1st Platoon, things changed dramatically when Clint Lawrence took over command. And this was a guy who had never, I believe, if I remember right, had never seen battle before until he joined 1st Platoon.
That's right. And again, there's that fate and circumstance. I mean, are these young soldiers of 1st Platoon fighting, if you can even call it that, honorably as they can, their first lieutenant gets gravely injured in an IED attack, and management, bureaucracy, in its infinite non-wisdom, puts into place a young first lieutenant named Clint Lawrence, who has no experience. He spent his entire deployment inside an air-conditioned tactical operations center. And suddenly he's now in one of the most volatile areas of Afghanistan, trying to lead this platoon of young boys who've literally been sort of surviving. And it just goes to hell in a handbasket. He is very unequipped to be there. He goes rogue, in essence, and orders his soldiers to fire on unarmed civilians. And in the military, it's all about discipline. You do what you're told. And this just blows up into this terrible war crime. Ultimately, First Lieutenant Lawrence is convicted of murder, sent to Leavenworth, and then, not to give away the plot twist of 1st Platoon, but, you know, he ends up getting out of prison because of a bogus pardon by President Trump. And when I say bogus, I mean biometrics, that big, unknowable system that I spent the book writing about, is actually used in a kind of house of cards way to manipulate the president into thinking something true, something false is something true.
Well, and media played a role in that because, as you point out, a key step to leading the president toward that pardon and to even trying to change the narrative about what happened with Clint Lawrence was the Sean Hannity interview on Fox.
That's right. And I think one of the greatest, most distressing things to me about First Platoon and about all the books I write, because I do write about the military and intelligence community, is that, and we see this more so than ever today, is this idea that somehow the Republican Party, or the right, if you will, is somehow the great supporter of the military, of the veterans, and the left, the Democrats, are not. And I find that is very dangerous presumption. And yet in this situation, you see that. You see all the Sean Hannity types, the Fox newscasters, leaping to the defense of a first lieutenant they don't know anything about, and they kind of get on board and drum up all this support for someone who was not at all what was reported by Fox News.
One of the things that makes the book so very compelling are the young people that you write about in the book and the circumstances that they encountered from Samuel Wally, and I don't want to give away much of the book, but particularly the story of James Twist. And it was heartbreaking for me reading it. I can't imagine what it must have been like for you after getting to know these young people.
You know, it's a story about identity, about human identity. It's true for each of us. Like, what is our journey in life? Where do we wind up? What do we make of the circumstances that befall us? And the boys, men, shared their stories with me. And I'm learning all about them as individuals, like that quest for identity. And it's juxtaposed with this very cold, scientific, technological quest by the Defense Department to gather identity dominance, to gather identification of people. And I found the way in which those two ideas interplayed, it was, like you say, it was like really upsetting at times because of the extraordinary sacrifices these guys make in Afghanistan and the stain and the trauma that comes home with many of them when they return to an America that seems not to be interested or even understanding of what it was that they did or why they were there.
There were a couple of quotes that stand out for me from the book, one from Bill Carney, who said, "Biometrics is not an exact science." And then there was the other statement that fingerprints don't lie, but people do.
And that's right. And that's really the great tragedy at the end of this, because when President Trump pardons the war criminal Clint Lawrence based on bogus biometric information, it really boils down exactly to that. You know, Bill Carney said biometrics is not an exact science, and he's absolutely incorrect. Biometrics is an exact science. The liars in this situation are the humans.
The whole other story on top of what happened in Afghanistan and the people there is the implications for the rest of us, as this technology is out there and we are very uninformed about what's happening. You point out the number of cameras, the number of visuals that exist on all of us in America and the world, and who has access and who controls that technology is, to me, very frightening.
You know, the big data systems that you're referring to, this idea of like, okay, we need to catalog everyone so that we know who is who, so that when a crime occurs, we can figure out who's responsible. That's kind of the fundamental beneath biometric capture. But the problem is the big data system that has to manage all this information, because it cannot be managed by humans. There's just too much information. And so you run into a problem here at home where it's now happening, and that has to do with our right to privacy, because Fourth Amendment, you know, that didn't exist in Afghanistan. You could pull someone over and say, "Give me your fingerprints, give me your DNA," and there's nothing they could do about it. You can't just do that here in America without probable cause. But while these debates are going on, and, you know, as you say, these surveillance cameras are keeping track of people and capturing, as we saw with the insurrectionists at the Capitol, grabbing their facial images right away. Well, those are going into databases, and then people must ask, what is the line of the right to privacy? So in other words, while the courts now debate all of this, you know, was that an illegal search and seizure of someone's facial image, and can that be used against them in a court? That is being debated at a slow pace. Meanwhile, these biometric capture systems and the big data systems that are moving around us, they're all moving forward at lightning speed. And in that gap, I think, is where the canary in the coal mine tale reveals itself. Like, what could happen next?
Annie, I wonder how much of this is perhaps the post 9/11 willingness of people to give up on some of their privacy rights, believing that it might make them live in a safer world.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with that question, because that is, of course, like the basis of a Western democracy, this idea of the social contract, hundreds of years old. You know, okay, so I'm a member of society. What rights am I willing to give up so that we can all kind of live, you know, in under democratic law? And so, yes, in theory, we want to be able to work with technology, work with this idea of the rule of law. But on the other hand, we're seeing right now in particular, at least I certainly am, this idea of the rule of law being sort of hijacked and manipulated and twisted into some kind of a political something, when in fact, it's, when you really think about it, Western society is that we actually behave according to rules and laws.
I wonder, too, when I think of how much some of the people in positions of power in Congress struggled to understand how social media even works, are those decision makers able to grasp, and are they concerned about the implications of biometrics?
Absolutely, they are, and they should be. And, I mean, you know, conservative justice now, who's now passed, Antonin Scalia, brought this issue up in the highest court of the land, the Supreme Court, in 2013, when he spoke of his fear that America could become what he called a genetic panopticon. The panopticon being this idea of, like, you know, a surveillance system that's watching all of us. And he's speaking to a case called Maryland versus King, whereby it came to bear of whether or not someone who was suspected of a crime should have his DNA, a cheek swab of his DNA, taken. And the idea was, if you didn't have specific probable cause, could you just do that at, say, a routine traffic stop? And that's exactly the kind of things that I think people need to be thinking about when we're thinking about biometrics. But, of course, in this incredibly fast-moving world that we live in, you know, again, who is actually keeping track of those, of how fast that system is moving forward, and how can the courts possibly keep up with it?
The book is First Platoon, A Story of Modern War in the Age of Identity Dominance. As always, incredibly well-researched and an absolutely fascinating and, I think, must-read for people, from Annie Jacobson. Annie, it's great to have you back on the show. Thank you, as always, for making some time for us, and we wish you well. Keep on doing what you do.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Annie Jacobson on Downtown.